when you're ready, let's start this game.
Welcome to Unstacked and Let's Unwind with author Christina Ward. Let's find out about her newest book, Holy Food, How Cults, Communes, and Religious Movements Influenced What We Eat in American History. Hey, this is Sarah from the Bay County Public Library.
Hey, this is Stephen from the Huntsville-Madison County Public Library.
Hi, and I'm Christina Ward. I am a writer, a food historian, and I run an independent publishing company.
Can you introduce our listeners to your incredibly well-researched and comprehensive nonfiction title, Holy Foods?
Thank you so much for the kind words. So Holy Food is nonfiction, but not academic in the sense that it's written for you, for general readers, because I was obsessed for way too long about this connection between religion, American history, and food history, and how that all converges to influence what we eat every day, whether it's in celebration meals or even in snacks. There's such a pervasive influence that so many folks aren't aware of, and that's the story I wanted to tell.
And after reading Holy Foods, now I keep an ear out just to hear about that combination of food and religion. I watched like the 12 days of the Tudor Christmas with Lucy Worsley, and I'm like, oh, they fasted for 12 days, and then they feasted and gorged afterwards. And I do watch a lot of cult documentaries, so also is pulling things from that. So what sparked your idea for Holy Foods, How Cults, Communes, and Religious Movements Influence What We Eat?
I think it goes back to childhood, as so many of our personal obsessions kind of grow from childhood interest. I was a kid who always asked why. I was one of those annoying, weird kids. And my mother was Catholic. And so I have memories of going to church, like say at Easter, where in our neighborhood Catholic tradition, food, all the women of the parish made a bunch of food and presented it to the altar for that blessing and then brought it home for their families to eat. I also spent all my summers on a very rural Wisconsin farm with my grandmother, and they used to, and this is the 70s where there were still revivals happening, and there was a great revival, great for us kids, great for the grandparents too, because they just sent a school bus and picked up all the kids. And so, of course, you know how kids are. Every parent in the county was happy to send the kids off for a few hours. But that story leads to, it was a very direct reward system. You got candy. You got an ice cream sundae if you memorized right verses from the Bible. And for me, that cemented very early on that a connection with food and how we practice religion, and food as a reward for religion too. And I think that's really, I thought about that a lot. That's the core start of all of that interest.
This is not your first cookbook. We've got, you did one about advertising and how advertising influenced America's eating habits. You got another one on preservation habits and tendencies of that. So when you go about making this historical slash like informative slash cookbook in a way, how do you go about picking your subjects and outlining the menu that actually makes it into the book?
So I'm a consummate researcher because it's fun. Anybody who's ever really, you know, has an interest in history or even watching documentaries, is the research is the fun part. I'm also a cookbook collector. I work in food. You mentioned the first book, Preservation, and I'm the master food preserver for Wisconsin. So if you want to know how to keep your pickles crisp, you know, reach out. But this idea of food and culture, because I think that there is so much history in cookbooks. There's so much about cultural history, from regional cookbooks to ethnic, kind of quote unquote ethnic cookbooks. It tells a different story of who we are and what we eat, and especially from a women's history. So much of women's history is kind of buried in those notes in cookbooks. I know everybody hates reading all those notes on an online recipe, but that's really where the good stuff is. That's where the culture is. And so that was the inspiration, and just amassing this cookbook collection and just following my interests. And that was, you know, what spurs me on. I'm not working on anything new at the moment because Holy Food took 5 years. So I promised my family and everyone that I was going to take a break, taking on new projects.
So kind of going off that, I am a sucker for weird cookbooks. It's one of those ones where if you can give me some kind of niche thing, where one of my favorites was, it was like 365 days of drinking with the saints or something of that nature, where it's cocktails based on all the Catholic saints and kind of stuff like that. So I will fall into a weird cookbook.
There are so many out there. Now, you mentioned my second book that came out in 2019, which is American Advertising Cookbooks. Again, that same thing. I always collect the Bianca. I don't know if you remember Bianca Breath Spray. Bianca published a cookbook, and one of my favorites because it's like an anti-cookbook in the sense that it only features recipes for the meals that would give you the smelliest breath in the world. And so you would need the Bianca Breath Spray.
Oh, nice.
You know, and so there was that period between like the 20s up till really early 80s where food marketing is primarily tied to cookbooks, as well as then other companies. Marlboro published a cookbook. Remington Rifles published a cookbook that was, of course, all game. So again, we have cookbooks as this kind of centering of not, you know, highbrow culture, but of common culture. We are Americans because of what we eat and why we eat. And I've said it many times, we become Americans through our stomachs because we're always challenged to eat new things. When I was growing up, there was no such thing as Taco Tuesday. Did tacos exist? Of course they did. But it takes this idea and this curiosity about what we believe and what we eat. And that helps make us more American.
And that's kind of where I'm going with this question, I guess, is this book has a lot of historical context to go along with it. It kind of dives into the social dynamics of race, gender, class, et cetera, that goes into our eating habits. So how did the research, the rabbit hole you fell down into? I want to know the background of all the stuff that you kind of fell into there.
Well, a part of it was a lot of discussion first. I credit my friend Martin in the back of the book because we had many great conversations over a couple glasses of wine. Because as you think about it and you do the research, I think anybody who's done any historical research, it's about putting together the connections. And you have to think it through and talk it through. And when you make a connection to one thing or person, that leads you down further rabbit holes and research. So for example, to your question, Stephen, is once I really cottoned on, there's an overarching theory about, again, religious belief, about the lost tribes of Israel in the 1600s that people in the UK sincerely and legitimately believed that they were the true Jews and that they were part of that lost tribe. And that idea got exported to the United States and to Australia and to Canada. But it also, once I figured that out and traced back, not just the origination, but then who adopted that theory and how they inputted it, it broke open for me so many more rabbit holes and ideas to go down because it became a unifying theory. And then discovering groups and religious groups that, again, because of they subscribe to this idea of a Judaic element to their belief system, incorporate the Jewish food rules into their culture. So groups like the Mormons, Latter-day Saints, even the Assemblies of God, people don't realize that they have originations and some of their culture comes from that theory from the 1600s. So that is a very specific example of going down the rabbit hole, having it break something new wide open, and then keeping and following it in different directions.
And you had a small group of your friends and neighbors that spent the pandemic days testing recipes, sharing their notes with you. I love this and I want to know more. The winning dishes and what might not have made the book?
Well, there's a number of recipes that definitely did not make the cut. And if anybody who's a really experienced home cook or is a fan of cookbooks, you develop a skill over time of being able to read a recipe and you can get an idea of whether that's going to taste good or you know, it's going to be a good recipe. There are a number, of course, you know, we experimented with that on paper looked like it could be good, but in practice was not good at all. In the book, I call out specifically a 1970s era commune, the True Light Beavers of Woodstock, New York, and they had a faux pâté recipe that seemed pretty good, actually. I mean, it's, you know, if you think about your charcuterie board and little pâtés and things, okay, it sounds good, based in mushrooms, and it was terrible. It hit the trifecta of terrible because the texture was weird, the taste was weird, it was kind of bitter and dirty, and so it had a, you know, that weird mouthfeel, the weird texture, the weird taste, an odd smell. So it hit all of the negative on your sensory system. And that, I think, still falls into the absolute worst. And some of the recipes in the testing, and I put it in the book in the recipe section, is the testers had some suggestions. And so I included those idea of like, here's the core recipe. And based on our testing, you might want to try this, this, and this to improve it.
I really wanted to try the shaker recipes. I didn't realize how much they substituted rose water for vanilla. And I looked up and I saw that they're still like a historical shaker community that sells rose water. So mm-hmm. I wonder if that's still tied. And one of these days, I will have to try Mother Ann's birthday cake or the shaker apple pie.
Okay. So I've of course, I tested those myself too. And Mother Ann's birthday cake is fantastic. If you're looking for a very kind of delicate cake, something reminiscent of what, you know, we in America, we call an angel food cake. So it's a perfect, if you were doing like a ladies' high tea, oh, that cake would be so, so good.
Oh, you sold me even more.
And it's kind of because when you're talking about the mouth textures and stuff like that, that can turn somebody off to something so quickly where like I can still remember myself sitting in the equivalent of a Denny's back when I was in high school and ordering, you know, a deep fried mushroom. And that was going to be the first mushroom I ever ate in my life kind of thing. And just the way that the mouthfeel of it. And to this day, you get a mushroom near me and I flash back to that and I'm like, nope.
So. Yeah. And that's, I think, something interesting about just Americans and food, because it's such an individualized experience. And that goes to the culture. And in when especially the groups that fall more on the cult scale, and that means they're super high control, it veers away from religious inspired, but though people may claim it's kind of spiritually inspired, but it's really about personal taste. So, for example, there are a couple of groups where I'm thinking about the group based in Los Angeles. Is there's usually a Hindu prohibition against onions, and yet the 3HO organization, because the guy who was Yogi Bhajan, who he personally liked onions a lot, so he put onions in all his dishes and for the restaurant and their cookbook, and so he's like, you know that prohibition on onions, talked to God and said, no, onions are okay.
And I guess that's kind of the question I kind of wanted to get into as well, is the there's almost like a cult of personality based around some of these food items, in the sense that the leader's personal taste and how that might have changed these prohibitions, like you just said. How often would you run into that when you're doing the research?
It, mostly in the modern, and what I mean modern is like kind of post-World War II, which is really that explosion of what we think about in the United States of the growth of new religious movements and cults and communes. That really happens after World War II. And then you get a lot of these, the leaders kind of cherry picking from both different belief traditions and different recipe traditions. I'm thinking, and again, not to go dark on folks, but Jim Jones of the People's Temple was infamous. He changed up their cuisine a number of times. For a short while, he wanted everyone to eat pork liver because he had read some article that it was really healthy for you. That didn't last too long. They experimented with vegetarianism, and he didn't personally like it. And so then what he told his believers was that they were not spiritually evolved enough to live without meat. So again, these personal choices get wrapped into spiritual practice, and that becomes where it becomes a little dangerous. Somebody takes that illogical premise of whatever and takes it to a logical outcome. And that's where you get the negatives, the real extreme, really horrible outcomes from some of these spiritual groups.
Kind of stemming from the Jim Jones, you interviewed Reverend Jim Jones' son-in-law, Michael mm-hmm. Cartmell. So what was that like in doing first-person interviews? Were you able to do a lot of first-person interviews for the research? I mean, there were some really amazing memories even within that about the gentleman who didn't want to join the People's Temple because he had painted the bus. He did not want cake because I guess they bribed people with cake.
I spoke to as many people as I could. And of course, the folks who are alive. And that's the predominance of folks post-World War II. I wanted so badly to go to some of the places that still exist. But as you mentioned earlier, the kind of the process, the research and writing was during the pandemic years. And so I was unable to. So a lot of email and phone conversations. One of the things that really became apparent, especially talking to both Mike Cartmell, who again was in the upper echelon of People's Temple, and then Mike Tashay, whose mom died at Jonestown and was Jim Jones's cook. And so there was definitely a stratification between the just general believers and the hierarchy. And that held true for a number of groups. So while the guru And his, you know, upper echelon of lieutenants often ate a much better quality of food and much different food than the believers did. And so that's one of the things that really came out with a lot of the interviews with people, that they had different experiences where it, depending on when and where in the hierarchy they were with the group.
It's fascinating.
Yeah, I thought so.
What goes into the editing process of a book like this?
A lot. So I think my friend Todd Davies, who is also a small publisher with Exterminating Angel Press, and she was acted as like an editor. And in the publishing world, we use the word editor, and but there's a couple different editors. There's kind of a development editor who's really helping read and shape and give advice onto, you know, are you succeeding with the goal? And then, of course, you've got copy editors and line editors and all of that addresses the technical. So with that explanation, Todd was that development and editor. And the first kind of draft that I'd sent her, her first response was, "What the heck are you doing?" And so it goes to show that everything is a collaboration and iteration. So that edit process was really a little paralyzing at first of saying, "What am I doing?" And it really forced me to sit with it, to sit with the idea of like, what am I actually trying to do here? And even just that one note, and again, there was also extensive notes about suggestions and different pathways and how to resolve some of the issues, the gaps, all of those things. Because when you're working on a project, and I think anybody who's, whether you've written a small restaurant review or anything, is you're challenged with, you're familiar with the material, and it takes someone who isn't and with fresh eyes to give you really honest feedback. And that is so important to anybody at any stage of a writing process, is to get honest feedback. If your best friend just tells you it's great, that is not helpful to you as a writer.
And I enjoyed the reading process, and I liked how everything was separated by like a time frame so that I could just read that section, let that mull over, because there's a lot of information. And even listening to other interviews of you, you're able to withhold all of this information in your head. I would like absorb it, and then I would just like let it go. Like, I don't even know how I could retain it all. From an archival perspective, did many of those cookbooks provide some of the religious commune or community history within the cookbooks themselves? I appreciated the recipes within the book that did have those notes.
Many of them did, because the cookbooks themselves, not every single one, but many of them serve dual purposes. They're trying to share recipes to help early and new adherents follow their prescribed diet, but they also can act as a recruitment tool. And mm-hmm. So those types of books, that those are the ones that give a history of the group and outline the practices and the spiritual beliefs of like, why are we doing this? This is why we're telling you. The Hare Krishna groups and their cookbooks were very, very succinct about telling you, this is why we do this. This is why we eat this way. This is why we cook the food this way. Some of the groups that we could kind of new agey, kind of what we'd call generally hippie groups, were much more kind of new agey about it, which was very, you know, almost a stereotypical light, love, peace, earth, you know, less helpful, but it does give you insights as to what their mindset is.
And I had the, for a brief while, I had found it in a donation, so I didn't keep it because it kind of smelled like, you know, that mildewy smell. Mm. But Molly Katzen's first copy of the Moosewood Cookbook, and how it's like all handwritten, which makes it really hard to read the recipes, but it's totally of the time.
And of the time. And we think about the Moosewood Cookbook, which is a seminal cookbook just in book history. It was just a game changer in really kind of that hockey stick of growth in vegetarian cuisine. Yet the roots of it, the Moosewood restaurant, that was a communal run restaurant. At the earliest days, they all lived together. It was set up as a commune collective that they were going to. There wasn't so much a spiritual aspect to it, but it had brought in that idea of we're going to be socially equal, culturally equal, live together, work together to build the community, that utopian thinking of let's build a restaurant and serve food in the ideal, most ideal way that we can conceive of.
Yeah, I think I could have hung out with them for sure, or still go up there. I think they still have the active restaurant, correct?
They do still have the restaurant, and they're just celebrating their 50th year anniversary. Okay. And most interestingly is the second generation of the original founders are running it. So it still has the vibe.
Yeah, I didn't need that reminder that the 70s were 50 years ago. Obviously, when you're dealing with a book about how religion impacts our eating habits, it brings a question of, you know, how food is important to religion. But I kind of want to twist this and say, how important is religion to the food aspect, did you find?
In many ways, for groups that are high control, that's the difference. And let me just go back for a second. And when I talk about what is a cult, it's very common right now to say, oh, you're in a cult. This is a cult. That's a cult. There is actually something called the BITE model, and it's an assessment tool. And most groups you've joined, whether it's the bowling league or your book club, will have like one element of control idea. We're all reading the same book. That's an element of control. Groups that fall into being called a cult are high control groups where they're controlling how you behave, how you think, how you feel, and then any of the information coming in. All right. So the groups that fall on high control lend themselves more to what Stephen is asking, which is that they really use the food to kind of influence some of the spiritual practices. And so, especially I'm thinking of like Hare Krishnas, which again, a very kind of mainstream and sedate today, but in the 70s, you were in danger of being kidnapped by orange robed people trying to take you away. That was the belief. But so the food is a way to teach this idea of prasadam, of it very simply, they offered to the god and to Krishna, and he accepts it, he blesses it, and then everyone eats it and, you know, shares that blessing. But the food, because they would, the Hare Krishnas served free meals. And so that food became a primary mover of their belief system of sharing meals and also then recruiting believers. Because if you were hungry enough, and there's still many different flavors of spiritual groups that do this today, is if you're willing to sit down for the free meal, you're willing to hear the spiel. So that food became a tenet of the spiritual practice because of how it worked to enhance the organization.
I was impressed how many just did do the giving away free food to bring people in. Like there was so many that were using that because there was the peace mission.
Father Divine's peace mission in New York, based in New York, from Amy Semple McPherson at the Four Square Church in Los Angeles. And a lot of that, then this is why I tried to write this as a broad, and you mentioned it earlier, it has social and cultural, political and economics, because if we think about prior to the 1930s in the New Deal, what we think about as social safety nets, food insecurity was a real thing. There was no governmental, there weren't food stamps. There wasn't social security. And so the people who were feeding people and taking care of their community were the religious organizations. And so, of course, these new religious organizations took up that mantle and did the same thing and expanded it and did it better, honestly. A lot of these groups were motivated because they were seeking new followers as well as seeking revenue. They essentially improved on the whole idea of, you know, the church ladies getting together and helping out, packing a basket for the hungry family, to free commissaries, free kitchens, free soup kitchens, and food pantries.
I can still see remnants today, even just within any of our churches, because even as a librarian, we recommend, well, you can get a free meal at this church, or there's the food pantry here, and they're often still religious based.
And they are. And this actually, then we can trace this back to like our earliest times of being human. If we think about a primary act of trust is sharing a meal. If I give you a cookie and you take it, you're trusting that I'm not going to poison you with that cookie. So immediately, as soon as we share a meal, we kind of start bonding a bit. And so within that bonding, we build a community, we build a tribe. So that is why food and religion are so closely enmeshed throughout all of our history, because it's how we build our communities. And again, in a modern way, it's how we become American.
You're giving me flashbacks again, because I can take myself back to high school and walking down the hall and having somebody in home that had just come out of home economics, having baked cookies and passing out sugar cookies, only to find out it was an onion and garlic cookie.
So. See, that's, and again, cruel. You didn't trust them, did you?
Not anymore.
Not anymore. And if they said, have a cookie and listen to my spiel about what I heard under a tree about my special revelation from God, as soon as you took a bite of that garlic onion cookie, you're like, no way.
No, we're good.
Not going to listen.
You had a little bit of humorous quips throughout the book, because most of it is factual, but you do reveal a little bit about yourself as a person. One, for example, is your footnote on Dan Brown and his awful novel. We still receive donations to this day of Dan Brown books. I mean, I think every home in America must have bought them. But how do you balance that, revealing parts of yourself within a nonfiction title?
Because as I run a publishing company, we publish nonfiction. And so there was a few models I embraced, and almost a non-academic, so academic rigor without the academic style. And I'm inspired by a writer from the early 1900s, and I mentioned it in the book, Gilbert Seldes. And it's kind of something, a vestige of Victorian era writing, is using footnotes as like a supra commentary on the text itself, instead of just kind of fact checking this. It's something that if you wrote that little rabbit hole note about Dan Brown in the actual text, it would be too distracting, but I thought worthy of a footnote. And in that way, I, as a writer, get to inject a little bit more of that kind of extra commentary and some of the extra facts that I found so fascinating and interesting that I thought other readers might find interesting too. And I think it also acts as a balance sometimes to some of the darkness that can be. Anytime you're talking about cults, there is always a dark side. So I was looking to have a balance for readers so they could have an educational, but an entertaining read.
And speaking of the publishing company, I am in love with this company just because it's got so many topics that are just right down my wheelhouse, ranging from Krampus to underground metal and glam metal, all kinds of music, all kinds of just niche weirdness that I love. Is there like a subject that you tend to just fall in love with in the stuff that you publish?
Absolutely. So I tend to, when people ask, what do you publish? And I usually describe it as high weirdness. And so it's high weirdness because I think, and that is, again, as Americans, as readers, I think we're interested and we can tell better stories by not always looking at the macro. And yes, we can read how many biographies of Abraham Lincoln and learn something about the country, but we can also learn more about different culture and how culture fits into the larger American culture by reading the smallness. And I like history writ small. And so when someone tells me that they've written a history and documented nearly over almost 100 metal bands in the United States from the 1980s who self-released records, I want to know about that. Maybe I'm not exactly a metal fan of music, but that is such an obsessive labor of love that I want to know more about that. And that is really what, when you ask what interest, that's what fuels me. That's what really fuels the interest, is tell me something about this weird topic that I don't know about, and then tell everybody else about it too.
Your call for high weirdness, you appeal to the subgenius in me.
Oh, yes. And, you know, and that's of an era. I think, you know, Stephen and I are bonding a second. We can recognize the Gen X in me sees the Gen X in you. And so, you know, there was something about that discovery era too, in that 90s, early, you know, pre-internet zines and this exchange of information. And there is, of course, a little bit of a recalibration. And like humans, publishing companies, we grow as well. What we published maybe in the early 90s wouldn't be what we publish today because, you know, information has changed as well as the culture has changed. And so we're always looking to bring the lesser known to readers and in whatever way we can.
And I don't know if we announced the name of that publishing company. I have it here, but you want to share a little bit about
sure,
it?
Sure, sure. Feral House. Feral House. And we have that in us, an imprint called Process. Process, as we always say, is less feral titles. And so that idea of Feral House, it's all nonfiction. Please don't send me your poetry and don't send me your memoir. I promise you, it's not really that interesting. I'm going to be mean about it.
You mentioned that this Holy Foods took you about 5 years to work with. Is that on average about what you spend writing on a book?
The previous ones, no. This, I really struggled, you know, and I'm going to be honest, I struggled with getting a handle on it, getting the approach right, and then getting distracted by research. And again, so many writers get distracted by research because that's the fun part. And then again, like so many writers, I'm still working a full-time job. And so, you know, you have limited time and space. A friend of mine described writing a nonfiction book as like having homework every night for a year. If that makes everybody cringe a little bit, that's pretty much what it's like. And so I hope when I take on another project, I always try to learn from the previous projects, and I hope the next one doesn't take 5 years.
And even while I was reading, I could tell you could have added even more information. So what is that like? Balance of how much you include so that everything kind of flows and allow your reader also to do their own rabbit holes as needed.
That was part of finding the way in and the balance. And so the choices made were, I chose groups that were exemplars, were the best example of the overarching theory of that connectivity and the influences of each other, and as well as burst from like different spiritual traditions. So there's a trajectory that follows Islamic traditions, Christian traditions, Judaic traditions, Hindu traditions, as well as Buddhist traditions. And so groups that could be the best examples of how America weirded out their original spiritual practices and their food.
It's funny to me how much of pop culture goes into a lot of these traditions, because I can think back to, like, we've got the Kellogg in here with his spiritual belief, and I can think back to 90s when we had Anthony Hopkins playing Kellogg, and was it Matthew Broderick and Dana Carvey? I'm thinking in The Road to Wellville. Where it's satirical in nature, but you don't think about these foods transitioning from religious belief into mainstream and that lack of awareness that they have, I guess.
Yeah, and that's often surprising to people. The Seventh-day Adventists were so influential in spreading vegetarian and vegan culture and vegan food in the United States in ways that people don't even realize. So, of course, the Seventh-day Adventists published cookbooks. They started sanitariums, like from Dr. Kellogg, also in Loma Linda, California. If anybody's reading Blue Zone studies about where the healthiest people in the world reside and what do they eat and what do they do in the United States, it's Loma Linda because of all the Seventh-day Adventists and because they follow this vegan diet. But to the larger point on how the influence and how this goes and where it's unknown is then a number of groups post-World War II, thinking like the infamous Source family. They were so very good looking and had a documentary made about them. So people like tend to know about them. In their restaurant, they used a bunch of recipes from the Seventh-day Adventists and from Yogi Bhajan. And so there was a lot of sharing of both spirituality and of food within these groups. And they kind of cross-pollinated each other to a point where you get food brands today like Kettle Chips. Kettle Potato Chips was actually started by Yogi Bhajan and his 3HO Happy, Holy, Healthy organization. The Morningstar brand of fake meat was started by the Seventh-day Adventists. They sold that off, but you know, it has that affiliation. The Worthington brand of and the Loma Linda brand of fake meat, those are still owned by the Seventh-day Adventist Church.
I had no idea, as a longtime eater of Morningstar.
Yeah. So, and that's where the practices, and it's to kind of paraphrase, it's only in America, kids, only in America could this happen because of that convergence of our First Amendment, how our tax laws are set up, and just how our spiritual practices are and our founding and what we believe as a country. And all of those things converge to make these kind of crazy hybrid church food businesses.
And that was fascinating to learn how with the tax law and then how that's a way that they made millions of dollars is creating some sort of food business on the side.
Yeah. And then there's also that spectrum of groups that are true believers. They truly believe in what they're practicing. There's a dogma and they create their businesses and the food businesses to really support that. And then there's, you know, bad actors as well who use the current like laws about taxation, business establishment, and the First Amendment to essentially skirt laws and to just build wealth and sometimes rip people off.
So not all were religions or cults. There are the agricultural-based communes, especially in the 1970s. And some things that you highlight in your book, I swear, are like movie plots, especially the one that I loved was the farm with rescuing Uncle Bill from a retirement community. I thought that was fantastic. And I want to see a movie about that. So
I do too. I hope somebody, I really do. And so the Uncle Bill story, just in a nutshell, is so the farm, which actually was a commune in Middle Tennessee, they did start officially as a kind of a church-ish, kind of a drug church. They left the drugs behind, but they still, you know, had their community. A member of the group had a great uncle who was a Jewish deli man who was in forced retirement at a nursing home in Florida. And he was so unhappy that a gang of the hippies from the farm went down and busted him out of the nursing home and took him back to the farm. And the influence there is that he taught them how to cook. And so to me, it's such a delightful story because they loved him and he loved them and he transformed how they ate.
And all the things that he was making sounded amazing, like onion mm-hmm. rolls and a turnip chip. That sounds good. I'll try that.
Yeah. And so, and again, this only in America of this, this man who was born of that, the Jewish Ashkenazi diaspora coming from the pogroms of the Pale in Russia to the United States, becomes an accomplished, you know, deli baker and delicatessen with the meats, and then essentially teaches himself how to vegetarianize all of these traditional Jewish deli recipes. Where else could you get a soy knish?
Was there anything else that surprised you in your research kind of like that?
I delight in those kind of oddball little stories because, as I was saying earlier, I think that really tells that larger story of America, that nuance, the nuance of when we think about eating together and sharing meals, it breaks down those barriers and we come together. So I do tend to love those stories. And that goes to the connectivity and how interconnected we are. And I think that was my biggest kind of revelation for myself. And I hope I got through in the book is how interconnected the groups were to each other, both in their food practice, their spiritual practice, and in many cases with personal relationships that the same people who founded the Latter-day Saints and the Millerites, which eventually became the Seventh-day Adventists, as well as the Fox sisters who kind of brought spiritualism, all heard the same preacher in the early 1800s. And so when you think about that level of interconnectivity, it makes our world so much smaller. And I think that we become better Americans when we think about the world as a smaller place and that we're all in this together versus separate.
Kind of speaking to that technology, obviously from where we, the history of kind of where we start at to today, there's been an advancement of technology. How has that changed how religions interact with food, be it like GMO or that community building through the internet? And has there, to tie into your previous book, has there been a shift based on the advertising of the food?
There's a couple different tracks on that. So the next wave of where you're going to see new religious movements, schismatic movements, is online. There's actually the term called cyber cults, where a group doesn't have a physical location per se, or have a very small physical location with maybe just a few true believers living communally in a house, but they have an outside presence because they have a YouTube channel, they have websites. There are a number of them that share cooking videos, just like every other, you know, home cook with a YouTube channel. These groups then are sharing recipes and cooking videos on their channel, but then they also have that added element that this is a spiritual practice and this is how you know, kind of become one of us. So that is where you're going to see a lot of that in the adopting technology. And another way, you don't see it as much as an outright advertising, but as an attractant and very much tied into like influencer culture. When you I'm thinking of a few groups that have gotten in trouble recently, rightfully so, that everyone on the channel showing, demonstrating cooking, and I'm not going to say who they are because they're not a great group, not good people. They were all young and beautiful and were very healthy. And so that was not so much they're saying, join our group, but they're like, watch us cook this meal on a beach and look at how healthy we are. And if that becomes like a very subtle influencer style attractant, and that's what you see a lot more of today, is about this aspirational lifestyle couched then in a spirituality as then kind of advertised by their food culture.
And even in just watching, I don't know if you saw the Love Has Won documentary, and then there's like the colloquial silver and alcohol as medicine. And it's all very weird, but very influencer based.
It can be very cultural. So I made a face and listeners can't see, but I'm a very expressive hand talker, is that I did speak to her in
what?
Part of the research. Yeah.
Really?
I spoke to them. I did not include them in the book because they, in my opinion, they were so unhealthy. I mean, it wasn't a group that I wanted to talk about or feature in any way, but I do have one of their spiritual energy pyramids they sent me. Because a lot of their food practice was, again, taking an illogical premise and taking it to the logical extreme, which, of course, always ends badly. And they were getting so restrictive on food And when it just becomes that endpoint of anorexia, that's not something I really wanted to talk about, because that's really what that group was going towards, as we see in the outcome, if anybody's watched that documentary. And it goes shows the power of both internet, because they were very cyber-based, as well as the power of that subscribing to that illogical belief. I would challenge anybody, when they're faced with their best friend telling them how great colloquial silver is, or telling them how great this group is and how they lost 10 pounds following this diet plan, I would always challenge people to just take a step back, look at the science, and do a little research. If it sounds too good to be true, it is.
And there was still some bad science in some of the other ones earlier on too. Now I can't remember which ones, because there was some note I have that's like bad science.
Oh, there is. And this is at the early 1900s and the late 1800s, when the science is new. Science changes every day. It's not written in stone. It's a changeable thing based on what research and what we know at this. This is what we know at this given time. And at that given time, they didn't know a lot. And so you had some food fads and some bad practices by a number of spiritual groups based on, you know, bad science.
Sidetracking just slightly here. Okay. We'd like to try to have a little bit of fun with our guests. And one of the ways we do that is we play a game. You might know it as something different, but we call it Kiss, Marry, Ditch. So I've got two different categories for you to choose from, and I've hidden them behind some secrecy. But inside those categories are three items that we're going to ask you to like, love, and one to get rid of. So the two that you get to choose from are Buttered Up and PB&J.
Buttered Up.
Okay, we're talking Julia Childs.
Okay. Wisconsin. I've got to choose butter.
So I'm going to make you rank the Julia Childs here, be it fictional or real life. We've got, obviously, the French chef, Julia from last year's, well, I guess now, 2 years ago, TV series, or Julia's portrayal in Julia and Julia?
I'm not a TV watcher, so I'm a little, I think I chose poorly.
Rank your Julia Child's appearances, be it fictional or not.
I will, yeah. How about that one?
Yes.
Yeah, the non-fictional. How about that?
PB&J would have made you rank I had some mascots here. I had Mr. Peanut, Miss Chiquita, and the Jolly Green Giant.
Oh, see, I should have chose PB&J.
Yeah.
Since I have ideas about that.
Let's go for it. Let's do this one.
So Chiquita Banana was, because it feeds into like the research I did on my previous book, is Chiquita Banana was actually created first before they hired Carmen Miranda. So Carmen Miranda was stylized after Chiquita Banana as kind of a marketing tool from that. So I put Chiquita right at the top. And then Mr. Peanut, he's my number two. And I'm sorry, what was the third guy? Oh, Jolly Green Giant. Yeah. I think that he is, again, being a Wisconsinite, I think of Paul Bunyan. And I think he's just kind of a low rent Paul Bunyan.
Oh, I mean, I can see it either way. one comes with a giant ox and one comes with, you know, peas.
Right. It's, you know, that's all he does is make vegetables appear. And if you're trying to market to kids, I'm not sure that's going to work so well.
I saw him in
who's him? Let's specify who him is real quick, because I want to know who you're seeing.
Jolly Green Giant. They had in the Thanksgiving Day parade, it was a funny float, but it was still kind of related to, I don't know, it was clever. Now I've forgotten it.
Well, and then I still have from childhood, from the 70s, is sending away can labels for a little Jolly Green Giant shaped transistor radio. I have that still.
That's amazing. I love it.
It's the things that today's society just missed, that we as young as of a certain generation got to send off for or what have you. I mean, geez.
Right. Oh, the kids are missing out today on all the junk that we had.
The unfree swag. You touched a little bit on this earlier, but I kind of want to double back when you were discussing about blue zones and stuff. As a whole, did you find that most of these religious dietary plans were both sustainable and or healthy?
Many of them are actually very sustainable and very healthy, especially the groups post late 1800s. They're vegetarian and in many times vegan. And we know, again, from Blue Zone studies and the Harvard Heart studies, is the a disproportionate consumption of meat of red meat especially can cause long-term damage to internal organs, specifically, you know, heart disease, artery hardening, enlarged livers. So yeah, especially some of the otter diets. One of the studies shows that if anyone's following the Nation of Islam diet, you are a very healthy person if you're following that. Elijah Muhammad put that together in the late 50s, early 60s. It is one meal a day. We'd recognize that as one of the current kind of health fads going on. It is heavy on beans for protein, very little meat. Most of the meat protein is fish-based, and lots of vegetables and greens and whole grains. You know, if that was just presented to you as a diet, most doctors would go, yeah, do that. But it's funny that that was presented as a essentially part of the religious practice.
And you collect cookbooks. So as a librarian, I have to know, what do your shelves look like? Are they organized in any particular way? And do you have any favorites?
Oh, I'm a book person. Yes. So I follow a Dewey system, honestly, for my nonfiction, because it's a great system. So it's not a perfect Dewey, but it is. It's a pretty good on Dewey. And then, of course, any fiction, which I have lesser of, is alphabetical. I do tend to then pull things out when in current projects. So if I'm sitting here, if I turn and I can see any of the books I was using for research are stacked next to me, hundreds of them, because, you know, kind of being actively used. And so then they get reintegrated into the collection. Kind of like Stephen, is the weirder ones are my favorites. I just got from my kiddo for Christmas as a present, an autographed copy of the Pearl Bailey cookbook, because I love celebrity cookbooks. So if you were, or not Pearl Bailey, I'm sorry, Minnie Pearl, mixed up the name. So remember from Hee Haw and the country comedian. So yeah, it's the Minnie Pearl cookbook that she signed. And so that is a new absolute favorite, because I do like kind of the weirdest ones.
That's lovely.
What kind of stuff does she put in there?
I didn't get to review it very thoroughly yet, but it's very 70s era Southern home cooking. That is the whole style.
So 70s Paula Deen, huh?
Yeah, a very 70s Paula Deen. And as to celebrity cookbooks go, I'm not as keen on the modern ones, because they're too self-aware, in my opinion. Mm. They have a lot of ghostwriters and they have a team of recipe developers, and very few are actual cooks. One of the best celebrity cookbooks out there, historically, Sophia Loren, she is a very good cook. And if you get her cookbook, her tiramisu recipe cannot be beat.
That's so fun.
I kind of want to say it was either, maybe it might have been Thug Kitchen, or it might have been Snoop Dogg, or one of those that kind of started me down my path, where you get the 50 Shades of Chicken and all the other kind of stuff that kind of goes along with it. But yeah, there's, looking back at where I started to where I got, that you can see the attention to detail that went into some over versus some of the other ones that had big name celebrities that went into it.
Some are just marketing pieces. But the ones that I think are great are the ones where they come from a real honest and genuine place, that someone is truly a cook. I have another, you asked some favorites. I have a signed copy of Loretta Lynn's cookbook. Loretta Lynn, she, before she became a singer and famous, she was a housewife in Washington State, and she won numerous state fair prize ribbons for canning. She was a fantastic canner, which speaks to my personal interest. So she was a good cook.
That's awesome.
So you've done a lot of research on recipes. Mm-hmm. What is the weirdest one you have found?
In all of time?
In all of time here.
Oh, wow. So I have a lot of personal prejudices that go in to inform that answer. I'm allergic to fish. Just fish, even the thought of it makes me just kind of cringe a little bit, because I have such a visceral reaction, allergic reaction. So there were a couple recipes in the most recent research that pops into mind that to me were just wholly disgusting. There's one from the macrobiotic folks for a shrimp pot pie that it is like super bland. And essentially it's like boiled shrimp with some boiled potatoes and, you know, not even no flavors, no sauces, nothing. And just even thinking about that, right, it makes you physically go, bleh. And that's the one that pops into my mind first most. It's just really just repulsive.
Yeah, I'm already out.
Yeah, that, and there's things that require preserved fish that kind of grosses me out too. No tuna fish casseroles or potato chip toppings for me.
And what are you currently reading?
What am I currently reading? I'm trying to get caught up on things. I have, very luckily, just working in publishing, I'm going to reach over it. I've just started this one. It's coming out soon. It's called Madness, Race and Insanity in a Jim Crow Asylum, and by Antonia Hilton. And I've just started it. It's fascinating. It's about that kind of rise of using state, you know, hospitals as a way to enforce Jim Crow laws. And it's, you know, these are darker histories. These are like the ugly parts of United States histories. But I think that we need to know this material. We need to know where we came from so we can go and be better people today. And so that's actually what I've just started reading. And I usually have a few books on the go. The other one, I'm going to reach and get it so I get the title right. Fantastic. It's small press in translation from the French. And it's called Free to Obey. And it's called How Nazis Invented Modern Management. And that one, it's a very short book, and it's mind-blowing about this whole, we're so consumed in American culture about productivity and how to and improving. And this researcher traces the roots back of that modern productivity culture to Nazi work culture. And it, again, eye-opening.
Ooh, I got chills just thinking about it. And exhausted at the same time.
Yeah. And that came out from Europa. So Europa Press.
Okay.
And I know you said you're taking a break right now, but this is the question that we ask generally to kind of get a hint when people can't tell us exactly what they're working on next. But I'm going to ask it anyway here. Strangest thing in your search history?
So while I was working on this book, I was working on another book because, you know, I'm nuts. And sometimes you get a challenge and an opportunity and you take it. And so I'm taking a long way to answer your question. Coming out in spring is a book I wrote for Inside Editions called The Happy Days Cookbook. And it's the 50th anniversary of Happy Days. I live in Milwaukee. I'm from Milwaukee. So I was asked to write the Happy Days Cookbook. I took it on because I said, I don't want anyone else to do it. I don't have time, but I'm the right person. I'm going to do this. So my search history is filled with so many searches about, did Fonzie like peanut butter? What did Richie Cunningham not eat? What episode did Ralph Malph burn down the apartment making Cherry's Jubilee? So that's my search history is bonkers on any kind of Happy Days trivia.
So we might actually find what food it was that the forgotten brother ate right before he disappeared and died up in the attic.
Yes, you will. And again, fun fact, the actor who played that, Gavin O'Herlihy, is the great uncle of a friend of mine.
Nice.
Because again, the world is small.
It is.
The world is really small. And I just encourage people to think about not how big the United States is, but actually how small it is and how much. You know, if you want to play 7 degrees of separation, I think each and every one of us can do that. And we'll find that if we don't know someone, we might actually just be related to them.
I love it. And we are a library podcast. So how have libraries impacted your life?
Tremendously. My dad used to say that they built a new branch of our local library based on the overdue fines of his kids. So one of the modern things, I'm so glad to see libraries doing away with that because it's such a library. I like it saved my life as a weird kid growing up, having a public library within bicycle distance with librarians who were encouraging and let me at age 8 borrow from the adult section and not just the kid section because I was interested in learning about the Peshtigo fire of 1871. I cannot just love libraries more. Even in this book, I was searching desperately for a picture, an image of Wallace Farrad, who was the founder of the Nation of Islam. Very hard to come by. I happened to be at work for meetings in Detroit, stopped by the Detroit Public Library, and had a half a dozen librarians who were overwhelmingly thrilled and found within 10 minutes the picture I needed. Libraries are one of the best things about the United States, our public library system.
So as we kind of wrap up here, is there anything else that you'd like to share with our listeners?
I'm a chatty person, as listeners can probably figure out. So I'm not sure what else I can really add, except that go to your library, check out books. And here's my insider tip on libraries. If the library doesn't have the book that you want, ask them. If they get enough asks, they order it in. That's your secret of your library. Make them get the books you want by asking for the books you want.
That's true. Perfect. Yes.
It's true. And even if we don't buy it, we can probably find it at a different library.
True. Yeah. So that's always ask. Your librarian is your friend and partner in research.
Thank you so much for coming on. Both Stephen and I, we saw your title of your book and we're like, yes, we would love to bring Christina on. So this has been a joy.
Oh, an absolute pleasure for me as well. I love talking about my research and I love talking about books. So this is fantastic fun for me as well.
Yeah, the research side was what I loved because I kept going. I was like, oh, I need to read more. And then
I think if anybody who's reading, really a reader, whether it's fiction or nonfiction, if mm-hmm. you're not making notes on building your next book lists based on mm-hmm. what you're reading, I recommend doing that. Always keep a little list of what's sparking your interest because that leads you down to more and better books.
And this one just hit every note I could because I was asked recently a book that influenced why I got into libraries and all that kind of stuff. And I can go back to, and you've already said the title almost. And it was High Weirdness by Mail. And it was all about weirdo conspiracy theories, religions, political beliefs, and all kinds of stuff that you could write off to and get free junk sent back to you so that you could, you know, get the weirdest stuff that you could ever think of. So this one was just like, yes.
I still have my copy of High Weirdness by Mail.
Yes. I'm sad that it didn't sustain time just because of how technology changed.
Yeah.
But I look back on it in fondness.
I do as well.
Thank you so much, Christina, for joining us on Unstacked. Holy Foods, How Cults, Communes, and Religious Movements Influence What We Eat in American History is available in the library collection for checkout.
It can also be purchased through your favorite bookstore and online vendors. Check out her website, ChristinaWard.net. That is ChristinaWard.net.
Stay safe and read, my friend. It's good for you. Bye.
Bye.